A shepherd on a desert mountain somewhere east of Sinai is having a conversation with God, who appears to be speaking to him from a blazing bush. So far, it's been quite a confronting encounter for Moses, who has spent his entire life away from the locus of Jewish influence. God has just tasked him with rescuing the entire nation of Israel from bondage in Egypt, which, from where Moses is standing, is a pretty big ask. With little or no idea of who or what God is, Moses has plenty of questions, the first of which is who exactly he should tell the Israelites' leaders is going to rescue them. God tells him that he is Yahweh, otherwise known as I Am. He is the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and I Am is the name that he shall be known by forever. The thinking behind this name is that God is the only God, that he was not created by anything or anyone, and that he is independent of laws. By calling himself I Am Who I Am, God is saying that he might as well be called I Am Who I Am Who I Am Who I Am, and so on ad infinitum. Put simply, he is the infinite and the one and only, and this name reinforces both of these. Yet it's possible that none of this means anything to Moses, who has lived half his life in an Egyptian palace and the other half here in Midian, neither of which have allowed him any contact with the people of Israel. According to Exodus, Moses is to tell Israel's leaders that God appeared to him, that he has seen what has been happening in Egypt, and that he has remembered his promise to bring his people into a new and fabulous land, reiterating that it is flowing with milk and honey. This is all new news to Moses, but God assures him that the Israelite leaders will listen to him and that they will approach Pharaoh together and tell him about this encounter. Whilst in the king's presence, they are to request permission to take their fellow Israelites into the desert for a 3-day festival where they can offer up sacrifices to their God. Moses is told that this will be an absolute non-starter as far as Egypt's king is concerned. Religious tolerance is not high on Pharaoh's agenda, and Moses is assured that he will only let them go if his arm is forced. However, God promises to strike the Egyptians with what he calls wonders, and which those who skip ahead a few episodes will appreciate is a masterstroke in the art of understatement. After this, God says, Pharaoh will let them go. Not only that, the Israelites' Egyptian neighbours will feel compelled by God to load them with gold before they leave. They will not only flee the country, he says, they will plunder it too. The news is a lot for Moses to take in, and he appears certain that the Israelites will take him for a complete charlatan. If read in the right way, God's attempts to convince his truculent messenger that he really is God is one of the funniest passages in the Old Testament. To assure him his journey south will be a success, God orders Moses to throw his staff on the ground. It immediately becomes a snake, and Moses runs away in terror. God then orders him to catch the snake by the tail. Boom, it turns back into his staff. God explains that this stunt alone will satisfy the Israelites that the God who they are deeply familiar with is at work through Moses. As if one miracle weren't enough, God orders Moses to place his hand inside his cloak. When he pulls it out, it is white and encrusted with a skin disease, which the Bible describes as leprosy. Yet, when Moses puts the hand back inside his cloak again, he is healed. God tells him to try these two moves out on the Israelites. If the first doesn't persuade them, the second will, he says. Moses still insists that God has picked the wrong man, particularly as he has a speech impediment and no public speaking skills. There is no consensus of what Moses' vocal disability might have been. It may be a stutter or a lisp, or it could mean that he is unable to speak Hebrew, having lived half his life as an Egyptian and half here in Midian. Exasperated, God tells him that it is he who helps people speak and see and hear, and that he will tell Moses exactly what to say. This is all very well, but at this point, Moses is still a definite no. Tongue-tied and completely out of touch with the race of people who he was born into, he is also still a fugitive. Hundreds of miles to the west, the crushing toil of the Hebrew slaves continues under a relentless Egyptian sun. But Moses remains immovable. God has got the wrong man, he says. He needs to send someone else. My name is Chaz Bayfield, and this is Holy Bible, Episode 16, Into the Brickyards. A quick note before we begin. This is the Bible minus any evangelism. Admittedly, I do get quite excited about the story, but great stories are great because they engage, excite, and endure. Holy Bible leaves you to make up your own mind as to whether there is any truth in them. The Bible I refer to throughout is Zondervan's New International Version UK edition, and the chapters I cover are in the episode notes. Now, back to the standoff on the mountain. Not expecting this level of resistance, God is left angry but still in need of a positive result. He suggests that Moses be accompanied by his more eloquent brother Aaron, who he says is currently on his way to Midian. The fact that Aaron is already undertaking possibly his first ever journey to see his brother suggests that God assumed Moses would be tough to convince. It will be a happy reunion, God promises, and Aaron will share with the people whatever message Moses gives him. Moses will be as God to him, God says, and he advises Moses to take his staff, which he later uses like a giant holy wand. Finally convinced that God really does want him to rescue the situation in Egypt, Moses asks his father-in-law for permission to travel there and see if any of his fellow Israelites are still alive. Jethro sends Moses on his way with his best wishes, and so he saddles up his donkey, grabs his wife, child and special staff, and begins the journey south. God reminds him that he has provided him with a whole kit bag of signs and wonders that will come in hugely useful, but warns him that he has hardened Pharaoh's heart, so he will not let the Israelites go. The world loves a good journey, and Moses with his staff and miracles is the prototype for Greek myths such as Homer's Odyssey, as well as more modern epics like The Lord of the Rings. The hero is sent on a mission and given special powers to overcome obstacles on the way. Moses is to tell Pharaoh that Israel is God's firstborn son, but because Pharaoh refuses to free its people, God must destroy his own firstborn. And so, the fugitive shepherd from Egypt dutifully heads south to tell the ancient world's most powerful man that he should seriously consider allowing his giant unpaid workforce to leave the country. On the way to Egypt, Moses and his family stop for the night in an inn where he narrowly misses being killed by God. Not being immersed in the culture of his ancestors, he is neglected to circumcise his son, and only a timely intervention by his wife with a sharp piece of flint averts the fury of the Almighty. Zipporah clearly does this to save her husband, not because she has any sympathy for the ritual of circumcision. In fact, it appears that she finds the whole ritual barbaric. She places her son's foreskin at Moses' feet as if in disgust, describing her husband as a bridegroom of blood. According to Exodus, God sends Aaron to meet his brother on the road. The two brothers might never have spent any time together. Possibly left behind by his mother when she's dragged off to Pharaoh's palace to look after her baby, Moses' brother evidently harbours no bad feelings and is happy to jump into action to help with the evacuation effort. When the men meet, Aaron kisses his brother, and Moses shares everything that God has put on his to-do list, as well as the miracles which he is expected to perform. Once they reach Egypt, Aaron summons all Israel's tribal leaders. The men are stunned as Moses performs his miracles in front of them. They are also overwhelmed that God has heard their cries and is concerned for their welfare. In awe, they bow down and worship him. Possibly still unsure what exactly is going on here in Egypt, one thing must be slowly beginning to dawn on Moses. Regardless of his past and his tenuous link to their ethnicity and religion, he really does appear to have become the Israelites' de facto leader. Readers are not told how Moses and Aaron are given an audience with Egypt's king, but when they tell him that God wants the Israelites to go on a 3-day journey into the desert for a religious festival, Pharaoh flatly refuses. After all, he has no idea who God is or why he should comply with his requests. The brothers ask again, telling Pharaoh that they fear God's revenge if they don't carry out his wishes. He may send plagues or violence to punish them. Egypt's leader remains unmoved. He reminds the brothers that he needs the Israelites to work. There are so many of them now that any trip to the desert will have an effect on national productivity. Pharaoh is clearly a sadistic tyrant, and for no apparent reason other than to display his power, he now decides to make things even harder for his enslaved workforce. He tells the Egyptian slave drivers that they are no longer to provide straw for the Israelites to make their bricks, and that the workers now need to find their own straw. Old Testament bricks are made of fine river clay, which dries slowly. Adding straw allows more air in, so the bricks dry more quickly. The brick quota remains the same, however, and so the people must work even harder or risk beatings and other punishments. The workers scatter in search of straw as the slave drivers pressurise them to maintain productivity, beating the Israelite overseers for failing to keep up with the expected quotas. A delegation of these overseers complains to Pharaoh, but he dismisses them as just plain lazy. That's why they want to take time off to make sacrifices to their God, he says. Miserable, exhausted, and dejected, the men find Moses and Aaron and vent their displeasure. The brothers have done them no good and have only made their lives harder. They have made them toxic to Pharaoh, and it feels like he has a sword in his hand ready to kill them. For the situation to improve, something dramatic needs to happen, and fast. Moses feels like a failure. The situation is now worse than ever for the Israelites in Egypt. He takes his grievance over Pharaoh's response directly to God, who is unmoved. Moses and Aaron will lead his people to freedom. Pharaoh will see what God is capable of, he says, and because of the intervention of God's mighty hand, Egypt's king will drive the Israelites out of his country. Possibly sensing a gap in Moses' religious education, God explains that he appeared to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, but to them he was El Shaddai, God Almighty, not I Am. There has been much discussion amongst those who study the Bible for a profession about why God calls himself by a different name for this mission. One suggestion might be that the three patriarchs simply received messages from God, but Moses acts almost like God and performs the kind of miracles that the others might only have dreamed of. In the book, God also tells Moses that he made a solemn promise to the patriarchs to give them the land that is currently Canaan as a homeland. Having heard the groaning of his enslaved people, he has remembered his promise. The brief to the brothers is simple. Moses is to tell the Israelite slaves that he is the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and he will free them from slavery, an act known as redemption. Now synonymous with Christian belief, redemption simply means the process of redeeming, or in other words, paying money to release something or someone. God may not be paying Pharaoh money, but he certainly plans to free hundreds of thousands of slaves. God announces that this act of liberation will be achieved by his outstretched arm and with mighty acts of judgment. Throughout the Old Testament, the metaphor of God's outstretched arm is used as a symbol of divine power and defence. What the acts of judgment are, God doesn't specify. He promises to claim the Israelites as his own people, and that he will be their God, and that when he brings them out of Egypt, they will know that he is their own personal deity. He vows to bring them to the place which he promised to their ancestors, and that the land will become theirs. The Israelites have no time for Moses all what they see as his paper promises. But God ignores this and tells Moses to order Pharaoh to let his people go. Moses is incredulous. How will Pharaoh listen to him if he can't even convince the Israelites, let alone with his speech impediment? God, being God, doesn't see any problems and simply orders him and Aaron to lead his people out of Egypt. At this point, Exodus lists the family heads who will bring their people out of Africa. Surprisingly, the only tribes mentioned are Reuben, Simeon, and Levi, the three eldest of Jacob's sons. The list is dominated by Levi's relatives, possibly as Moses and Aaron are Levites, and so it might be assumed that their tribe will fall into line behind them. At the end of the genealogy, readers are reminded that Moses and Aaron are the ones who were chosen by God to organise the evacuation. In the book, Moses is told by God that he is to act as a conduit, telling Pharaoh everything that God asks him to pass on. As to how his plan is guaranteed to succeed, he will make Moses like God to Pharaoh, and Aaron will be his prophet. It's a simple case of the brothers following God's instructions and trusting that, despite their overwhelming belief that it won't, the outcome will be a positive one. God will harden Pharaoh's heart, unleash judgment on Egypt, and bring his people out of slavery and into a better place. Not only this, by witnessing the power of God's fury against Egypt, the Israelites will be confident that he alone is God. It is now that God steps in to show the most powerful man in the world that he is hopelessly outclassed. Readers are told that at the point where they approach Pharaoh a second time, Moses is 80 and Aaron 83. This may seem old, but in the genealogy which Exodus has recently shared, several of the men in their family live past 130, which adds a little more context to the brothers' age. This really is exceptional longevity, given life expectancy among rural tribespeople in the Near East today. Bedouins in Israel can expect to live to around 77. The Bible doesn't explain why Moses and Aaron live so long, nor does it point out that living beyond 100 is exceptional. According to Exodus, God briefs the men what they should do if Pharaoh asks them for a miracle. Aaron is to throw down his staff, which will become a snake. The brothers are given another audience with Egypt's king, and to impress upon Pharaoh that they are working on behalf of God, Aaron throws down his staff at Pharaoh's feet. True to God's promise, it becomes a snake. Seemingly unfazed at an unknown nobody throwing a dangerous reptile at him, Pharaoh has his magicians perform the very same trick with their own staffs. Incredibly, Aaron's snake then eats all the other snakes, and almost as incredibly, Pharaoh remains unimpressed. For him, it's a case of nothing to see here, and the two brothers are no doubt left wondering what it's going to take to make this particular king change his plans. Pharaoh may be unimpressed with Moses and Aaron's magic show, but God appears to have a plan far beyond the imagination of the two brothers or the Israelites whose freedom they are pleading for. Unlikely as it may seem, Moses is now the leader of over a million Hebrew slaves. What happens next is one of the most incredible sequences of events in the Bible, and one that cements in the Israelites' minds that God is A, powerful, and B, very much has their backs. Over and again, later books in the Bible turn their readers' minds back to the events that play out in the Nile Delta as Moses and Aaron lock into a furious battle of wills against Egypt's stubborn king. This is the Bible at its most epic. The onslaught against Egypt is next. Holy Bible is written and produced by me, Chaz Bayfield, with music by Michael Old and John Hawkins Music. Cover art is by Lisa Goff. Please follow us on Twitter and Facebook or send feedback to contact@holybible.com.